DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of the programme focusing on the women of Europe in war and peace.
I would say that in many other political ideologies, violence can be tolerated to a certain extent, whereas in feminist tradition, right, we always against violence because violence always targets the most vulnerable groups.
We'll be hearing from the Russian feminist resistance and the Ukrainian front line, as well as spending an evening in the company of Thelma Ruby, the nonagenarian performer for whom the show must always go on.
In a couple of weeks, I'll be 98. I have to be so grateful that I'm still well enough and strong enough to be able to get up and do a show.
Welcome to our Women of Europe special. It was a working title, and yes, we do know that it could be catchier, but somehow the title stuck, probably because it's such a no-frills description of what, and more importantly, who this programme is all about. That's the sound of the original Pussy Riot punk prayer, the anti-Putin protest song which shot the balaclavaed Russian feminist collective to instant fame when they were arrested for performing it in Moscow's Cathedral of Christ the Saviour back in 2012. Since then, the popular image of Russian dissidentism has been female. But what is the reality of feminist organising now that Russia is at war? To find out, I spoke to Alexandra Sasha Talavier. Sasha's a PhD student in gender studies at the Central European University, where her focus is on Soviet-era feminism and struggles for reproductive justice. She's also an organiser with the Russian feminist anti-war resistance. More on that in a moment.
To be honest, the first days I was pretty much paralyzed with any type of political action or anything because, yeah, as you know, I'm from Zhytomyr, Ukraine, and that's where my family lives, my grandma, my aunt, my uncle, my cousins, and lots of friends as well. And that's the city that was bombed on the very first day of invasion. So, of course, it felt differently, right? During these first days, we were mostly thinking about what our family should do, whether they move somewhere or not, and just trying to digest what's actually happening to be able to act upon it. But at the same time, yes, because I'm a feminist activist and I used to be involved in feminist organizing in Russia, I am in all these chat groups and I know lots of feminists, consequently. And on 25th, Ella Rosman, one of the co-founders of the feminist anti-war resistance, asked me to help to circulate English language translation of the feminist anti-war resistance manifesto. So I got involved through that. And then, I don't know, two weeks later, she also suggested me to join in administrating Telegram channel of the feminist anti-war resistance. So basically, what was that, right? The feminist anti-war resistance started with this manifesto that was drafted by a number of feminist activists and then translated into many languages. And it invited everyone who shares our values to join us via social media platforms. And mostly these platforms are Telegram channel, Instagram, and Twitter. And in the very beginning of the invasion, when we still had lots of people in Russia and very few abroad, the division of labor was that people who were abroad, including me, were responsible for administration of these social media channels, because if Telegram, let's say, gives away our data to Russian security service, we are more or less safe, right? We are still Russian citizens, which doesn't make us safe ever, but at least we would not go to prison immediately. So initially, that's how I joined. And the idea of Telegram channel of the feminist anti-war resistance was that activists throughout the country were able to send us their suggestions, ideas, or reports about their actions via Telegram bot. And then we would public it anonymously so that they would be safe and at the same time being able to convey the messages to the broader audience. That's how it started, and we've got not only like social media subscribers, but many sales that were established in Russia and outside, and we have approximately 20 feminist anti-war resistance cells or chapters, and we, if we want to pretend that we are not that underground in Europe, and not even Europe, also we have a cell in Brazil, in Southern Korea, and in Russia we've had approximately 60 different groups that were acting autonomously, and the structure of the movement is that we have these numbers, many, many different groups that are very loosely connected with each other, but still are able to communicate via Telegram channel. But now we are also establishing bigger infrastructure or environment for activists in Russia to be able to communicate with each other anonymously in a safe way.
Sasha Talavir is a member of the Russian Feminist Anti-War Resistance. She's also a PhD student in gender studies at the Central European University. Wars can be about resources and power, but they can also be about stories, about control of the narrative. In the case of Russia's war with Ukraine, the story was simple. Ukraine, it went, did not exist. It was a historical aberration, a glitch that needed to be fixed. But Ukraine, of course, did exist, and with it a rich literary tradition over which the figure of the 19th century poet and playwright Lesya Ukrainka hangs, something like a national patron saint. "Our death," she wrote, "will teach others how they ought to live." No wonder that when I asked Ukrainian literary scholar Tatiana Ogakova about women in Ukraine, her mind went straight to Ukrainka.
For me, Lesya is the founder of what we are and what we'd like to become. It was a prodigious woman speaking in many foreign languages and representing this intellectual tradition. She was in close dialogue with European history, with European tradition, but at the same time, she was so deeply Ukrainian. You know, and she was just providing us with this possibility to link both, you know, Ukraine to European tradition, to ancient, to Greek tradition, for example. And I would say that her life could be an example, you know.
Геть ти думи, ви хмари осінні, тож тепер весна золота. Чи то так у жалю у голосінні проминуть молоді літа? Ні, я хочу крізь сльози сміятись.
Thoughts away, you heavy clouds of autumn, for now springtime comes, a gleam with gold. Shall thus in grief and wailing for ill fortune all the tale of my young years be told? No, I want to smile through tears and weeping, sing my songs where evil holds its sway. Hopeless, a steadfast hope forever keeping, I want to live, your thoughts of grief away. In the long dark ever viewless night time, not one instant shall I close my eyes. I'll seek forever for the star to guide me, she that reigns bright mistress of dark skies. Yes, I'll smile, indeed, through tears and weeping, sing my songs where evil holds its sway. Hopeless, a steadfast hope forever keeping, I shall live, your thoughts of grief away.
That tribute to the seminal Ukrainian poet and playwright Lesya Ukrainka was from Ukrainian literary scholar and journalist Tatiana Ogakova. Ukraine's resistance to Russia's war of aggression has, in the words of First Lady Olena Zelenska, taken on a particularly feminine face. Amongst those feminine faces are those of international volunteers who rushed to Ukraine's aid and defence. Volunteers like, and yet one imagines never quite like, Sandra Anderson-Ehre.
Eira is a Norwegian Sami. She grew up in a culture dominated by fishing and reindeer herding, going on to skipper her own boat with a crew of five men, and then serve as a member of Norway's Sami Parliament. When war broke out in Ukraine, however, she knew that her place was on the front line as a medic. Lars Bavanger has been following her story.
Is that a rocket?
Irpin, near Kyiv, March 2022. A unit of international volunteers are fighting back Russian invaders. Footage posted on the Instagram account of a 36-year-old former commercial fisher from the Arctic north of Norway. Why? Because she's been with the group as a frontline combat medic and volunteer in the Ukrainian armed forces since the war started a year ago. Her name, Sandra Andersen Eira. She's hard to track down these days as she moves with the changing front lines in the eastern regions of Ukraine. But then I notice on her social media she's heading to the USA for some training, and I managed to get hold of her there.
Well, see, the thing is that I quit fishing because I was tired of being cold and hurting and hungry and uncomfortable. I was actually thinking about starting a more normal life. I was just, I'm going to quit, like I'm done, like I'm tired of being uncomfortable. And then I went to Ukraine.
From age six, Sandra had been listening to the stories of her family doctor, who'd been a medic in the Middle East. She knew she wanted to do that too. But her first job was at sea. By the time she was 34, she owned her own fishing boat with an all-male crew.
My grandfather, great-grandfather, all of them fishermen. But I never had any intention of being one. It just happened one day when my cousin asked if I wanna come see what it's about. And I just happened to love it.
Now, the fisheries industry and war are both overwhelmingly male environments. Has that ever been an issue for you?
I understand that there are some hesitations and doubts about having females along because it is male-dominated. War is war. But for me, again, it's like fishing. It really doesn't matter what you are. It's about who you are and just being able to do what it takes. For the Ukrainians, I have been treated with nothing but respect and decency. They have been awesome to work with. I've never felt worried. I've never felt like it was a challenge for me as a girl to be amongst them. They have been very, very respectful as me, as a female working with them at war.
Where are you from?
Norvegia.
Oh, Norvegia. Do you snakke norsk?
Do you snakke norsk?
In Ukraine, no day is the same for Sandra. Often, she evacuates injured soldiers from the front line, like in this clip from her Instagram, where she helps a Ukrainian soldier who happens to know a little Norwegian. Other times, she transports soldiers killed in action.
Sometimes I get medical gear or combat gear into country from Norway or France or US. You can get hit by a cruise missile and you can step on a landmine, or you can just get shot. You can get kidnapped because you're Westerners. It's about playing it smart and surround yourself with solid, skilled group of soldiers. And I have been very fortunate to do so.
Sandra Andersen Eira is indigenous Sami, and her family are both fishermen and reindeer herders. This joik, a traditional Sami singing style, was written and performed for her by Hans Ole Eira, a distant relative and a fellow parliamentarian from the Sami Parliament. Sandra served as an MP there between 2017 and 2021. The Sami indigenous group spans Norway, Sweden, Finland and Russia. There is a clear Russian influence in the part of Norway where Sandra's from.
So I'm used to growing up with them as neighbours and friends and classmates and colleagues, especially in the fishing industry and also in my family.
Many Samis from the Nordics and Russia see themselves as one people. Russian Samis had routinely participated in cultural and political events before the war. All that has stopped. Today, both as Sami and Norwegian, Sandra has to draw a clear distinction between the Russians she knows and what is happening on the battlefield.
You can't punish innocent people that doesn't have a say-so. Most people in Russia doesn't even have a say-so. You can't blindly just hate the entire population in Russia for what their government is doing.
Sandra has served in Ukraine for more than a year now. She reminisces back to the 8th of March when she was stuck in a basement on the northern front north of Kyiv.
With the Russian paratroopers and helicopters and tanks, artillery, mortars, cluster ammunition, you name it. And then all of a sudden, the Ukrainians I was with came and gave me some candy and a pair of Ukrainian socks and said, Happy Women's Day. So for me, that was very special, you can say, because I was literally standing there in the cold with two walls just blown out and bonfire in the corner. Ukrainians being so happy. There was a woman there to celebrate International Women's Day and just lift the spirits.
Sandra hopes she won't be needed in Ukraine in yet another year from now, but she'll stay and help for as long as it's needed. And after that?
That is a very good question. And the answer is, I have no idea. If there's another war, yeah, we kind of have the lessons learned now. So being able to help out in other wars too, whatever it has to be, we have definitely learned a lot from this one.
Lars Bevanger, DW.
Do you have questions or feedback about that or any of the other items in the programme? Or maybe you have a suggestion for someone else whose story you think we might like to feature on the show? You can reach us at insideeurope@dw.com. This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Time now for a real treat. Get your glad rags on because it is showtime. A show that started almost a full century ago in the form of the phenomenon that is the actor Thelma Ruby. Born Thelma Wigida in 1925 in the English city of Leeds, her mother had been a child performer in music hall billed as Paula Ruby. So when Thelma started acting, she adopted her mother's stage name, Ruby, and became Thelma Ruby. She's been performing professionally for 8 decades, taking in everything from musicals to Shakespeare, serious drama to pantomime. And she's no intention of retiring anytime soon. Danny Mitzman went to visit her at her home in Wimbledon, London, and came back with a portrait which is almost as colourful as the woman herself.
Gee, but it's good to be here. Frankly, I feel right at home. There's nothing like this stuff anywhere. There's a magic that's in the air. Gee, but it's good to be here.
My first professional performance, I was 19. And in a couple of weeks, I'll be 98. I have to be so grateful that I'm still well enough and strong enough to be able to get up and do a show.
Gee, but it's good to be here.
During the war, I was evacuated with my mother to New York for 4 years. I went to school there, I went to college there, which is where I studied acting and the theatre. And I came back here. The war was still on. It was October 1944. And at 19, I was eligible to be called up, and I saw that you could do national service by entertaining the troops. I lived in Leeds with my mother. I'm a Yorkshire girl, and my parents. And mother came with me down to London to Drury Lane Theatre, which was the headquarters of what was called ENSA, which was entertainment for the troops. We stood at the side of the stage in Drury Lane, watching the auditions. There was an old lady playing the violin. There was a very portly, bald tenor singing, "All things come home at eventide." I thought, well, I hope maybe I can do better than that. And the show Oklahoma had opened in New York, but it hadn't come to England yet. So I marched on and sang a song from that show. "I can't say no." And I saw them in the audience waking up and taking their feet off the seats in front of them. And when I finished, a man came running on the stage. I hadn't done any professional work before that. He said, "Oh, you're just what I'm looking for a show that starts rehearsing next week." And that was my first performance. And it was in hospitals all over the country, sometimes on airfields or army camps, often in stately homes, which had been turned into convalescent homes. And I grew up very quickly. There was a whole audience of boys who had been blinded. There was a whole audience of boys who'd lost limbs. And perhaps the most memorable was on VE Day, May the 8th, 1945. So the boys with no faces, no ears, no noses, no hands, but what an audience.
"Can't stop talking about him, talking about him, talking about him. And if he was yours, well, neither would you."
Things are much better for all of us, and especially for women, yes. Now you can have dignity and you can have your say and you can be yourself too. You know, you don't have to be what someone else tells you you should be.
I know that song.
So he sings, "Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga choo-choo?" And then we're all going, "Choo-choo" at the back, you know. And one day at rehearsal, the line where he's supposed to sing, "There's gonna be a certain party at the station, satin and lace." So he sang, "There's gonna be a certain party at the wedding." So the director said, "That was very good, Ty, until you got to the wedding." He said, "That's life." I was actually co-starring with, my name was above the title, with Judi Dench in the musical Cabaret. That was 1968. Topple, four times I played the mother in Fiddler on the Roof, three times with him. And then I was sort of leading lady with Orson Welles. He put two parts of Henry IV together and made a play called Chimes at Midnight. And I was mistress quickly to his Falstaff.
"The dove each moment is bolder. The lark sings Ich liebe dich."
I can't pick out a highlight because I've enjoyed, I think, everything I've ever done. One of the best feelings that anyone can ever have is when you make an audience laugh, when you hear a whole audience screaming with laughter. It's just life-enhancing. It's just wonderful.
"The flea, the moose, his love call is making, but nobody's making me, nobody. Nobody's chasing me."
The phenomenal Thelma Ruby there in that portrait by Danny Mitzman. Thelma's one-woman show will be back in the summer, so keep an eye out, particularly if you're going to be in London. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Women of Europe special continues now with so many strong and distinctive voices yet to pack in.
There's such a level of sexism, and many times they don't even consciously know that those comments are not compliments, but actually sexism. I faced many, many times that I arrived and they commenting how nicely I look like, and finally somebody with a nice smile, you made my day. I was the only woman in the room.
More from that Hungarian politician very shortly, along with gender studies academic Sasha Talavir, a selection of Albanian businesswomen, UK campaigners against police misogyny, and a dead French woman still saving lives from beyond the grave. Stay tuned.
Broadcasting from Germany, this is Inside Europe.
When I was preparing for this programme, I spoke to a lot of different people, journalists, academics, and also my elderly East German neighbour, about the role of women in the Soviet Union. Whether by coincidence or not, all of them mentioned the same two things: men handing out roses to women on International Women's Day, and the so-called double load, by which women would work full-time but then still come home and take care of all the housework. Gender studies academic Alexandra Sasha Talavir, though, also looked very much to the radical legacy of Soviet feminism, a legacy in direct contradiction to the version of history favoured by President Putin.
What Putin refers to, and Russian government often, to this more superficial way of, more superficial level of Stalinist mostly propaganda.
There's an order of motherhood that he's brought back, isn't there, or something like that?
Yeah. So there was this always attempt, right, to put this wild emancipatory energy that came with the socialist women's emancipation back into family, back into something more convenient for reproduction of autocratic society. And that's what Putin does, right? She restored this order of mother heroine that was initially introduced in the Soviet Union in 1944. Putin reintroduced it in 2023, which is incredibly wild idea, because it is an order for women who give birth to 10 or more children, right? And this reproductive strategy is absolutely extreme in contemporary world.
And how explicitly linked is this to the idea of war, of long-term war, of the need for young men, basically?
I mean, yeah, one of Russian Orthodox Church priests said that women in Russia should give birth to more kids, preferably four at least, so that if they lose one of them at the war, they don't feel so sorry. And it's interesting that we also can see, so on the one hand, definitely demographic crisis has been going on in Russia for the last three decades. That's actually the case. And I think that what's very important also given the war is that according to some demographic forecasts from before, they were alarming that by 2024 or by 2025 in Russia might be not enough young men to serve in the army. So I would say that this kind of, and then by 2050, Russia will cease to exist due to demographic crisis, right? So we've been living in this horrible demographic crisis that was framed as a part of state security issue. And therefore, of course, question of reproduction of new generation to be born and raised is, I would say, at the center of current Russian propaganda. And I would say that Putin's obsession with LGBTQ questions, trans issues, gender issues are very much, and young people as well, and youth, right? They are very much linked with this crisis of reproduction, fear and anxiety about the fact that Russian population will not be able to reproduce itself. So there is a lot of pressure, and again, they started the ban on child-free propaganda is discussed now in State Duma. Legislation that will remove abortions from state insurance is discussed in State Duma again. They introduced new law on so-called LGBTQ propaganda last autumn that prohibits any type of non-heteronormative representations in public media, right? So all these efforts, they aim to create monopoly of heteronormative nuclear family with kids in the public space, right? So basically to make it impossible to promote any type of other representations of family, even though this nuclear family with two parents and many kids is such a marginal phenomenon of Russian actual life.
Sasha Talavia is a PhD student with the Gender Studies Department of the Central European University, where her focus is on Soviet-era feminism and struggles for reproductive justice. And the echoes of those struggles could be heard in a conversation that I had with Stefan Boss, our Budapest correspondent. Hungary became a satellite state of the Soviet Union until its breakup in 1989. Its current president, Viktor Orban, has turned the country into what he calls an illiberal democracy, clamping down on freedom of expression and favouring a strongman brand of politics. Stefan's idea was this: why not get a feel for attitudes towards women in Hungary by hearing from two female politicians from opposing sides of the political divide? Here he is to introduce them.
Well, you know, the first woman is Anna Donna. She is 35, and she was involved in founding the Momentum Movement Party, and she is now a European legislator.
It's completely okay if a man in a suit says something smart, or if they have an agenda and they stood up for that, even if it's a bit aggressive or too straightforward. This is what they expect from a man. But if a woman stand up and show emotions, there are a lot of stereotypes about that, it's better connecting to our cycles, or it's because we are hysterical. And anyway, why the hell I'm talking instead of raising kids or making dinner? Especially on a political sphere where you are entering in a meeting, a plenary debate. There's such a level of sexism still exists, and many times they don't even consciously know that those comments are not compliments, but actually sexism. I faced many, many times that I arrived and they commenting how nicely I look like, and finally somebody with a nice smile, you made my day. I was the only woman in the room.
Well, she really doesn't mince her words, does she?
No, indeed. And I think it really defines her in a way. But it's very interesting how she views the politics in Hungary.
Yeah, and I mean, I have to address this. Hungary, you know, notoriously, Viktor Orban has a very strongman approach to politics, only one female cabinet member. However, the elephant in the room here is that it does have a female president.
Yes, indeed. And that is the other woman I wanted to mention. She is President Katalin Novak.
You've spoken to the president, Stefan.
Well, I didn't speak with her, but I have, through a colleague, I got some sound from her. And what is really amazing from her, that she is not only the youngest ever head of state of Hungary, but she is also the first female president of this country. And, you know, she's a 45-year-old mother of three. She's a Calvinist Christian and a staunch defender of Hungary's traditional family values. But she's also the president of a country that, like many European nations, still suffers from a low birth rate, which, by the way, Orban's nationalist party says threatens the country's future. So President Novak says she wants to inspire women to be pro-family while at the same time pursuing a career.
I'm a mother of three children, so I'm not only a woman president, but also a mom. And that makes me understand much easier, I think, what it means on a daily basis to struggle this imbalance, I would call it, of family life and the professional career. For me, family is the most important. But on the other hand, I love my job and I would like to have my professional job or career as well. And I think these two can go hand in hand with each other, even if it's not easy. And if we speak about this and if we give this over to the younger generations in a positive manner, not going against anything, but just underlying the beauty and the importance of childbearing and traditional family, then I think that we can help these young people.
Let's just widen it out a bit, Stefan. Do you expect a growing role for women in Hungary, nevertheless?
That's a very interesting question, because Prime Minister Viktor Orban has sought to emphasize what he has described as traditional values in his self-proclaimed illiberal democracy. Now, that includes enshrining in the constitution that marriage is comprised of the union of a man and a woman. And critics say that basically also excludes gay marriage, for instance, at the moment. But there was also a controversial report by the state audit office here, and that concluded that too many female college graduates threaten the economy and demographics, making it more difficult for them to have children. Now, the report even had the controversial title Signs of Pink Education in Hungary. But once again, ironically, President Novak and opposition leader Donat both encourage women to be involved in the tough challenges ahead for Hungary.
So a point of agreement there. I think we better quit whilst we're ahead and leave it there. Thank you so much, Stefan. That's a fascinating insight there into two very different takes on female roles and political life in Hungary.
Indeed. You're welcome.
To Albania now, also formerly communist, though not actually part of the Soviet Union, where small and medium businesses account for more than 90% of enterprises. And many of them are run by women. The country is relying on female-run businesses to offer options for young people who've been leaving the country in large numbers. But that doesn't mean there's universal respect. Guy Delorne reports from Albania's capital, Tirana.
We are not doing this event in English tonight.
It's a rainy Wednesday evening in Tirana, but it's warm and dry inside as startup grind gets into gear. This is a regular session which aims to inspire Albanian entrepreneurs and help them cultivate the connections which can make the difference between success and failure. And on this occasion, there's a female focus, as both the organiser and the special guest are successful businesswomen.
I talk to most of entrepreneurs in Albania, and they feel usually lonely in their journey. And Startup Grind is about making your journey less lonely, let's say, by getting together and sharing these challenges.
Aneida Bakhtari doesn't just organise Startup Grind Tirana, she also runs a successful accountancy business, Balkans Capital, employing more than a dozen people.
The situation is not very good. People are trying to find opportunities outside the country, and what I want to show, and what my vision is that you can stay in this country, you can get good salary, you can have a good life here without going outside and live in this country.
Despite the problems, Tirana's buzzing with building work and traffic, so it's easier to walk the short distance across town to Destil Creative Hub. This is where Sunila Abdali has established a multi-story, multi-purpose space for creative entrepreneurs to meet and exchange ideas. And she's particularly proud of its Academy for Women Entrepreneurs.
It supports women with an early stage idea to develop their business. Then we design it also to contextualize it better with Tirana.
But grassroots initiatives alone won't be enough to help Albania's female entrepreneurs thrive and multiply. The government's aware that it needs to set the tone and facilitate funding and development. Half of Prime Minister Edi Rama's cabinet are women, and Entrepreneurship Minister Edona Bilali is among them. She says the very existence of her ministry shows that Albania realises the value of entrepreneurship.
It's an investment toward creative thinking for young people, and the sooner we start, the better are the chances that young people will continue to live in Albania and will continue to think in a way that they could work from here, but also be international employees.
Hannah Vintage Corner is one success story. It's created a community around a cafe, carefully curated collections of vintage clothes and special events. But co-founder Uada Begai says Albania's female entrepreneurs face depressingly predictable challenges.
The workers, the technicians, they would not speak directly to me.
even though I was paying them.
So they would like talk to me through the architect because he was like man responsible for the project, which was very disappointing. So they also thought like I was very young and no one really took me very seriously, even like the landlord. It bothered me a lot, especially in the beginning. It felt like it was not my thing anymore. Like the concept was mine, the idea was mine, but like I had no authority.
There's plenty of potential in Albania and an understanding that to make the most of that, businesswomen need better support. Now the challenge is to change attitudes on a wider basis so the country's female entrepreneurs can excel. Guy Delaunay, DW, Tirana.
European democracies are based on an unwritten social contract whereby laws are there to protect citizens from harm and the police are there to enforce those laws. But what happens when a large segment of the population loses faith in the police? That is the scenario that unfolded in the United Kingdom in the wake of two deeply shocking cases involving police officers who used their power to harm women. In the first instance, the murder of a young woman named Sarah Everard, the police response to women holding a peaceful vigil in her memory made the breakdown of trust immeasurably worse. From the UK, Lucy Taylor has been following the story.
The police have the nerve to threaten us and intimidate us.
It was March 2021 when a young woman, Sarah Everard, was abducted and murdered while walking home from a friend's house in London. Her killer, Wayne Cousins, used his police warrant card and handcuffs to force her into his car. It was a case that lit a touch paper among women across the UK, especially after police shut down a peaceful vigil for Sarah in a way that a court later ruled was unlawful.
I think part of being locked down was that everywhere you looked, all of Twitter was just, it was Sarah's face everywhere. And she had done everything right and everything I hadn't done a ton of times. And I think it just really struck me that even if you do everything right and you're the perfect victim, you, our hope and our ability is to make decisions about whether or not we live the rest of our lives is taken away from us. And then the fury when it was a police officer. And basically,
Jamie Klingler was one of the women who planned that vigil, her first taste of activism. And she also founded a campaign group, Reclaim These Streets. Her life since then has turned 180 degrees, campaigning for women's safety and police reform.
Other than me tweeting about a vigil, every single action after that has been done because the police antagonized us. Like, if they had just let us have the vigil, we would have had a moment of silence and gone back to our lives on Sunday, but it was everything they did was about silencing and shutting us up. The word radicalized is never used about people that look like me or sound like me, but I've been radicalized. The stuff I've learned about the police treatment of those communities that are under-policed or over-policed, depending how you put it, over-policed and under-respected. I can't put the blinders back on.
Wayne Cousins was convicted and sentenced to life in prison for killing Sarah Everard. And he was also sentenced for three cases of indecent exposure he carried out in the days and weeks before her murder. Campaigners believe if those crimes had been swiftly investigated, her killing may have been prevented. And then another extraordinary case. Another former London officer, David Carrick, was convicted of 24 counts of rape, all committed while he was in the Met Police. The convictions make him one of the UK's most prolific sex offenders.
There's no question there are lots of very dedicated, fantastic police officers and police leaders who really want to do better.
Fiona McKenzie is the founder of The Other Half, a new policy group in the interests of women.
But there is also a core of policing which has been extremely malevolent. I think there has been development of a really toxic culture in policing, and something that we've seen is this kind of almost pornographically grim communication between police officers where they're using social media like WhatsApp to discuss victims and pornographic content around victims. And it's so extreme that it feels like that's a major cultural issue for the police.
The Met Police has said it's truly sorry for failing to act sooner against Carrick and said its work to root out corrupt or criminal officers is determined and focused. Some 800 officers are being investigated for complaints of sexual or domestic abuse. Harriet Wistrich is the director of the Centre for Women's Justice.
Certainly the Met Police, they've had no choice but to take drastic action, which they are apparently taking, in terms of reviewing all the officers who've had complaints or criminal convictions against them and taking action in relation to those officers. You know, they have no choice, because if they didn't do something radical, I think the only option would be to break up the Met Police altogether and kind of replace it with something completely different.
We say no! Everyone agrees changes won't happen overnight. But campaigners say they fear women's trust in the police has been shaken and could take a lifetime to be fully restored. Lucy Taylor, DW, in the UK.
When women speak truly, they speak subversively. They can't help it. If you're underneath, if you're kept down, you break out, you subvert. Words of wisdom there from one of my own personal feminist heroes, science fiction writer Ursula Le Guin. This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Now for something truly different. The story of a dead woman who is still saving lives from beyond the grave. You probably already know her face, and you may even have kissed it. Kiss of life kissed it, that is. More than 200 million people worldwide have been trained in CPR, but very few have ever given a thought to the disembodied head and torso that they were given to practice on. Since the 1960s, Resusci Annie has been instrumental in improving the survival rate of those who suffer from cardiac arrests outside of hospital. In fact, it's estimated that 2.5 million people have been saved as a result of CPR. So who is Annie, and how was she invented? Bella Jewell has been finding out.
It is really quite incredible to think about how this death mask went from a death mask to a kiss of life. She's certainly the most kissed woman in the world.
From a death mask to a kiss of life. This is the story of how a drowned woman found in the River Seine almost 150 years ago became the face of one of the most important inventions of the 20th century. She's a face we all know and may even have kissed without realising it. This story begins in the Norwegian city of Stavanger in the 1950s, when a man called Osmund Laerdal returns from America. His company, Laerdal, began as a publishing house, producing beautifully illustrated children's books and wooden toys. But it was on his trip over the pond that everything changed. He was shown a new and revolutionary material called plastic.
Band-Aid plastic strips with new super stick better than any other bandage.
Here's Jon Laerdal, his grandson, and now senior vice president of Lifesaver Solutions at Laerdal Medical.
He went home with plastic and started experimenting with PVC in the oven, which of course stank. The company became a very successful toy company. Big part of the toy success was Annie dolls.
Annie dolls were an early version of those plastic babies many of us played with as kids. Their faces were quite lifelike and came with special clothes and combs for their hair.
This is in 1954. My father is 2 years old and he's playing on the pier into the fjords of Norway. And he's playing with his elder brother and elder sister. They are at the pier, and all of a sudden my father is in the ocean, only kept floating by an air pocket in his raincoat. His brother and sister are screaming. My grandfather runs down from the cabin through the woods, jumped into the ocean, pulls out my father, able to clear his lungs from water, give him mouth to mouth, and he resuscitated him.
Osman's son, Tore, Jon's father, could have drowned that day if it wasn't for his father using an early but not widely taught form of CPR. So when an Austrian doctor, Peter Safar, who's known as the modern father of CPR, and a local anesthesiologist called Bjorn Lind asked him for help to create a mannequin for CPR training, he jumped on the chance. But these mannequins needed a face, Dr. Peter Safar's technique required chest compressions as well as mouth-to-mouth breathing.
My grandfather was visiting his grandparents, and on the wall they had this death mask hanging, which many say have this enigmatic smile, and she's referred to by many artists as the drowned Mona Lisa. And the story goes that around the year 1880, a young woman drowned in the River Seine in Paris, and they made a cast of her body so that people could recognize her and the family could be aware. And that became a mysterious and beautiful art piece, to call it that, that it became a popular thing to have on your wall. So again, my grandfather saw that on the wall and thought, that's perfect.
The Inconnu de la Seine, the name given to this never-identified woman, inspired artists throughout the 1900s. And for Osman, she was the right balance of realism and beauty. Here was the face of a dead woman, as are people who have suffered a cardiac arrest. But she wasn't off-putting to look at. And just like Lerdal's already famous plastic doll, he decided to name her Annie.
Yeah, now you're getting to the end of the cycles.
Rissosi Annie was introduced in 1960, and she's doing better than ever, having trained, for example, 10% of the UK population, mostly in schools, the last 7 years, called Mini Anne.
Technology has taken great leaps since the 1960s, when the first Rissosi Annie was launched. And looking around the factory in Stavanger, you can see high-tech dolls of all forms, different body types, skin colours and ages, even mannequins of newborn babies.
This is where we store our raw materials.
It's because Lerdal Medical wants to make training products as realistic as possible to achieve their goal to help save a million more lives every year by 2030. One of those lives was that of Lara Badger.
I went to my dad's house and spent the evening with my dad and my sister. And then I went, oh, Dad, I don't feel very well. I feel a bit dizzy and started shaking. And then I just sort of collapsed. And he had, about 2 weeks before, just done a CPR course through work.
Lara had had a cardiac arrest, and it was her father's knowledge of CPR, having trained on a dummy, that meant he could restart her heart while waiting for the ambulance to arrive. You see, the first 10 minutes after a cardiac arrest are crucial.
Yeah, I've had an amazing life just because my dad did a CPR course through work. I was 24, so super young. I went travelling, I travelled the world, just went to America and South America and Australia. And then after I got back from travelling, I moved to London, worked in some amazing places, like I've worked in Parliament and I've worked for government. I met my husband in London, started the adoption process, and then I found out I was pregnant. So.
And Lara isn't the only one who's lived a full life after being resuscitated. That young boy who was saved from the fjords by Osman in the 50s, well, he's now the executive chairman of Lerdal Medical. Here's his son, Jon.
I would strongly urge people to spend a couple of minutes to take some CPR learning, because typically that happens to a loved one. It is, as I mentioned with my grandfather, a traumatic experience. Of course it is. Most people have not seen a dead person. It's a dead person you're helping save. You cannot do no harm. They're dead. But you can save them.
The unknown woman and the development of the CPR mannequin are stories rooted in tragedy. But for over 80 years now, they've been helping avert just that, giving the young, the old, family members and strangers the best chance at life.
Bella Jewell there. Did you know that medics recommend that you perform CPR to the tune of the Bee Gees' Stayin' Alive in order to get the rhythm right? That kind of feels appropriate for this programme. Reluctantly, we have reached the end of the show. The programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Nick Martin and sound engineers Wissam Tharman and Gerd Gayorgi. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.